this podcast has been disqualified from the Academy
due to Spanish language. That ain't fair!
I'm sorry, but those are the rules. Whatever the merits of this conversation, we have very strict rules that we need to abide by.
Maybe we can have a talk about this.
We can talk, but rules are rules. They must be enforced.
Well, can we still carry on this conversation with a director who had his film disqualified for similar reasons?
You can do what you like, but if you expect accolades, laurels, and honors from the Academy, you're making a big mistake. Rules are rules.
But don't rules have a loophole of sorts, some way to get around it?
We do not have loopholes here in the Academy.
Well, do you have ice cream then?
Ice cream is something we gave up long ago. We are a serious organization, and if you must insist upon such trifles, perhaps you shouldn't be in this business in the first place.
Well, with attitudes like that, I suppose there's only one thing to do. Roll the interview.
No Academy Award for you.
Oh, shut up. Okay, so I am here with Iran Kulleran, who I hope I have pronounced correctly, or at least
almost
somewhat perfectly. Almost. Who is the writer-director of The Band's Visit. Iran, how are you doing?
Yeah, good. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. The first thing I want to ask you about in relation to this film is your use of static shots. We open with a static shot. There are often in the foreground a lot of rolling vehicles and cleaning carts. And then as we progress through the film, we see many static shots of the desolate freeways, of the highways. And I wanted to sort of ask you how the static shots kind of came to be. Are you just a big Antonioni fan, or what's the deal?
I am an Antonioni fan, even though I think with Antonioni it's different. Antonioni has a lot of tracking shot and following shot, and this movie is more static. It has more like a picture, like a snapshot approach too, which I think mostly came from, I'm very fond of, I grew up on comic books. And I tend to think of the cutting and the shooting in those separate frame. I usually prefer not to cut them on the motion, but to get the characters to the static position and then cut to another angle, which is like going from frame to frame to frame, you know. I think it also came from something in the movie itself, which is because it's kind of a fable and a fairy tale, and you know, the way that I had to tell it, that would be very clear that it's kind of self-aware of it's being a fairy tale, or it's like saying there was a man and there was a woman and there was a road and there was a train and there was, I mean, this is, I had to kind of translate this kind of storytelling into pictures, and not saying, there was a man who lived here and there and his mother was doing this and that, and you know, it's not this kind of storytelling, it's more a fable storytelling. It's, there's a man, there's a woman, there's a road, and so in this also evolved this kind of static, more picture approach to the movie, and at the end of the day, it's also something very, it's something instinctive. I don't know, sometimes you shoot a scene and there is tension in the air and there's time flowing and just two people standing and they look at each other and you just want to tell them, you know, just don't do anything, just sit there and look, because it's happening. Something is happening, you know. And on those moments, I would just ask them to continue not saying anything, just being and living.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you mention this, because you signal to the audience early on. We see this static shot in the opening, and then when they arrive at the airport, you have the photographer take a picture. So it's very clear that, okay, audience, you're in for a sort of static kind of film.
Yeah.
But in relation to this emphasis that you're talking about, I'm wondering if you find it easier to edit around static shots than moving shots.
I don't know. You know, it's not as if I have all the opportunities and all the roads open for me and I choose them. It's very instinctive, and it's also something that I don't really know how to make all those tracking shots with a lot of people coming in and coming go. When I sit behind the camera and I see those things, it's just make my mind too much mess in my mind, and I say no, you take you take the all those how do you call the standings away. I don't want to, you know,
the C-stands, you mean, or
the, no,
or the just all the technical details, basically.
No, the people, you know, you fill the frame with
people.
Yeah. No extras. They are, I don't want to see the extras. they are making me confused, and let's put the camera static because the movement made me confused. Until I'm not confused and I see it, and it's clear to me that it's very simple. There's a table, there's two chairs, there are two people talking, and I like it this way, you know.
Yeah.
And it's not so, and it's something that grows from your instinct at the end of the day, and not. And it's not that, you know, I could do anything and I choose to do this. I just, this is what I know to do.
It's interesting you mention this because in the shots of Rhodes, again, we see nothing. We see not a single car. Maybe, I think I may have seen a tumbleweed in the distance. Yeah. I don't know. But I wanted to also ask about the infamous shot, the most striking shot, I think, is the moment where you have the three figures, of course. You have the ladies' man suggesting to Poppy,
yeah,
who claims that there's C in his ears,
yeah,
and who is just completely incompetent when it comes to women.
Yeah.
And you essentially have, over the course of this shot, which never moves, this 3-minute shot, or maybe 4 minutes,
yeah,
where he's basically instructing him on what to do. You know, he, yeah, takes a flask of alcohol out. This is very much something that is essentially stripped down to its basic elements, and I'm, yeah, curious about this. Was this really the only way to depict this particular era?
No, you see, so a lot of things, you know, they evolved longer, because to begin with, we had the more complex shooting for this scene. Mm-hmm. I had several shots to break this scene down, and I knew it was a very important scene in the movie. I knew I had to get this scene. But we started shooting it, and we do one take, and we didn't have a lot of material. We ran out of stock, of film stock. So, you know, and I look at my photographer, Shai, and he looks at me, and we say, hey, let's be sure to have this one shot works, because we don't have not the time and not the money to have the other shots. We have this, and this shot should work. So let's, you know, concentrate on only this shot. So we kick out all the rest of the alternative shots. We stayed with this shot. And, you know, it's also one of those scenes that it's, you know, when you shoot them, that you have to make it one take, because otherwise you'll cut it along the way. Otherwise, you have, at least when you shoot it in one shot, you're sure it's either in or it's out. But no one can tell you, oh, let's this scene a little bit shorter. You cannot cut it. So you better make sure that you have only one shot for this kind of scene, because otherwise, at the end of the process, you'll end up cutting it and, you know, taking out all the soul from it.
Now, by one take, do you mean long take, or did you actually do one take?
No, I mean one shot. You know, have one shot. Don't have two shots, because then you could intercut between them, and you'll end up doing it much faster and less, you know, less nice. So it's better to have just the one shot. No, I had dozens of takes on this scene. I think I had 13 takes. On this scene, 13 take of 4 minutes, and you're seeing the third one, which, uh-huh, is just, you know, more than all show how insecure I was, just continuing taking another take while I could live with a third one. And
what about these other 10 takes that came afterwards? Why didn't they work?
No, they were all good, because my editor, he phoned me and he said, oh, I've seen this scene. I love this scene. I've seen it. He called me from the editing room. So I told him, which take did you take? And he said, I don't know. I've opened it on the third one. It was nice. I took it in. I didn't watch the other ones.
Wow.
So I remember after in the editing process, we said, okay, we sit and see the other takes, just, you know, not, you know, to make sure. But we stayed with this third take, which he just opened, saw it, and it was complete luck that this one worked. And you know, I liked it a lot in this film to have these static approaches. On the one hand, you know, it's kind of more theatrical approach. But for me, it's sometimes when you do theatrical thing, it's more cinematic in the way that you have a strong sense of camera all the time. You have the strong sense of frame. And I don't want necessarily to say all the time to the audience, you know, this is life, I'm shooting life. No, it's okay. I think I like it when I like it in films when I see the directors walking. And I know there's a camera, and I know he walks with the camera, and I like it. You know, it's craftsmanship that I like. And I like it also in this movie that you have the frame, and you feel that it's a fixed frame that someone put it. And on the one hand, it's completely artificial, you know. But on the other hand, what they do inside the frame has a good craftsmanship of movement. It has, if the actors are, they know how to move, they know the gesture, they know, so what's happening inside is interesting, and it has this tension, and it's not theatrical. Not that I care about all those definitions, what's theatrical, what's cinematical, but, you know, though it has a sort of theatrical approach, it has something very cinematical for me, because it's something that camera does. You put, it's like you have a small video camera, you put the frame somewhere, someone goes in the frame, and suddenly it's magic. You know, he has his own time inside the frame, he moves in his own way inside the frame.
While we're on the subject of technical details, I have to ask you about the role sound plays in this film. You have the clattering sign, for example, when the band first arrive. You have shots where you hear nothing but the roll of luggage.
Yeah.
Again, we're sensing that you're very much a man of stark qualities. So
stark?
Stark qualities.
What's stark?
Sort of stripped down qualities, essentially.
Yeah, you know, I was very much, when we started to ask ourselves where will we film the movie, I had this question in my mind, because this kind of architecture that is existing in this small town exists in a lot of places in Israel, also in the center or also in the more city areas, those kind of architecture. So if you take the picture alone, it does not have the feeling that those places have, until I got that the feeling that those places have is in the sound and not in the view. Mm-hmm. Because you would have in a lot of places in more close to the center of Israel, you would have the same colors, the same architecture, you would have a little roads or desert or things like that, but you wouldn't have this feeling, and this feeling comes from the sound. So we had a lot of work with the sound. We went on for the night to the desert, we recorded the actual sounds there, and until we found the actual sound of wind and the way that even when you walk in the desert, like those trolleys in the desert, the sound is different, it's dry, it's very, you can hear from a very far away. So to have this, what could make the picture to put out this place, you know, to get out the place.
So it's very much a kind of topographical consideration, essentially. You needed to capture that place through both sound and visual.
Yeah. I knew with myself that when I go out of the bus in those kind of places, I have a very kind of a feeling that I couldn't describe, but it's a feeling of distance, mm-hmm. a feeling of, I don't know, of ways, of distance, and how to capture this, because you can shoot a road always, but alone it doesn't have this, and this feeling comes from the sound of the sand underneath your feet, the sound of, this is what builds the place, this is what gives you this feeling which does not exist somewhere else, is the sound that makes it.
Gotcha. There's one thing I wanted to ask you about. I read an interview you conducted with Filmmaker Magazine, and you basically suggested that there was no way for you to separate the personal from the political, and that because you have this theme of identity and lost identity and the like. But I want to put forth this question to you. Well, identity isn't necessarily political. You can go almost any place and, you know, lose your identity or have problems adjusting to a particular society. So I have to ask you about that. Maybe someone might view this film and look at it more as a sort of personal narrative. Or is there sort of a certain risk in kind of being a more subtle filmmaker for a larger theme like this? I mean, is it always political to, or is the act of making a choice, do you view that as a very inherently political choice?
Yeah, everything is political. It's inherited, as you said, in the choices. Even if you neglect politics, it's a political choice. If you overlook politics, it's a political choice. Everything is political, and, you know, and I have my own political awarenesses about things, and they find their way into the personal story. And you know, you say if someone can go in and see this movie only as a personal and, you know, relate only to this, yes, this can happen, you know, I'm not in charge of, anyone can see the film and, you know, take something else from it. For me, it talks, it has politics inside, it has a personal side in it, it has my own thoughts about art, about filmmaking, about a lot of things, you know, which is me, but I'm only one person who sees the movie.
Let's talk about personal experience. How much of this did you draw upon? I mean, and also, this gives us an interesting question of where did you invent? I mean, did you personally ever approach a girl and say, do you like Chet Baker? How did that actually occur?
No, but I was the shy guy in the roller skating rink. This is a very strong personal memory that I have from my youth, being clueless with girls, and my friend comes to me and says, they opened an ice skating rink where we can meet a lot of girls in the ice skating rinks, which is completely idiotic, someone having ice skating in Israel in 40 degrees in the but they built an ice skating rink, and I remember this experience for the whole night, just clinging to the, how do you call it,
the bar on the side,
just clinging, hoping not to fall. And the girls are always too far away. They are skating, you know, like ballerinas on the skating.
And did you actually accidentally push a girl over at some point?
No, not this. But I just remember this feeling of, you know, you came here to meet girls. They are skating so far away from you. You're always too far from them. You can never get to them while holding this bar.
The Alexandra Police Orchestra, was this based on any specific orchestra that you observed or that you listened to? Because I actually tried to do some research on this, and I was really curious.
No, nothing is based on true facts in any way. It's all in my mind, you know, but, you know, they are like all police orchestra. They are dressed in stupid uniforms, and they are this strange combination of working men and art men, which I really like.
Which is interesting because they have a very particular hat that I was fascinated by. The curve on the hat is very, very pronounced, and I'm wondering how that design decision came about.
No, I don't remember any specific decision about the design of the hat.
Really? Did you just let that to your costume designer?
Yeah, no, the only big things were... Well, the how do you say, the design of the clothes, which is very kind of old colonial clothes, English, this form of the clothes, because we were wondering if to have more kind of orchestra uniform, like to have like a conductor uniform, or to have this kind of more army uniform. And the second big choice was to have the color of the uniform very out of this world, you know. But about the shape of the hat, you know, it just came about from the designer.
The epaulets on the side, as well as the badges, I'm wondering how that came about. Each of them has a badge signifying what instrument that they're actually playing.
No, it was funny because all those signs, I had my cinematographer, it was just before this movie, shooting a movie inside Egypt. They went there to do some shooting for another Israeli film. And he went to this shop he had this very funny story about being an Israeli cinematographer in this army shop inside Egypt buying the signs for the band, but somehow he got them and smuggled them back to Israel, and we had all those signs.
Going back to the image question, you have a lot of shots of mirrors in this.
What?
Mirrors, where you have characters look in the mirrors, particularly in Dina's apartment, and I'm wondering how mirrors kind of reflected the ontological plight of many of these particular characters about being sort of lost and being catapulted into this kind of wasteland. Just this last question.
Mirrors, you said?
Mirrors, like looking into the mirror in Dina's apartment.
What's mirror?
A mirror, like looking into a surface, like in the bathroom, for example, you look at yourself.
A mirror?
A mirror.
What's a mirror?
A mirror. Mirror.
M-I-R-O-R.
Oh, M-I-R-R-O-R, yeah.
Ah, okay, mirror.
Yeah.
Where are you from?
Well,
why do they say mirror? There are a lot of shots of people looking, you know, not necessarily on mirror, just looking on just... how do you say... looking in
reflection,
nothing specific, you know. I don't know what's the expression in English for this. It's like and looking without anything specific. It's mainly those things that happen through shooting, that you have someone looking, and it's something that the camera does, which I have no other way to describe other than magic. You know, it happens. You put the camera, the actor is there, he's just looking, he has no expression, he's thinking something, and it's alive, and it's happening. And it's not this, as you try to imply, a kind of this analytical thing with the ontological, you know, state of the character themselves. It's something that happens. A guy walks in the frame, and he looks, he thinks about something, and he becomes, I don't know, like an icon.
It's sort of an instinctive choice.
Environment
kind of dictated. Yeah. You saw the mirror, and then
you see him look, and you say, you know, just don't move, you know. Stay like that. Something is happening.
Well, anyway, I'm being ushered out, but Iran, thanks very much for talking with me. It was a pleasure.
A plague in the workhouse, a plague on the poor. Now I'll beat on my drum till I'm dead. Yesterday a fever,